It was a short-lived political movement that barely lasted a year, but its legacy is still being felt today. Black Panther Woman is the untold story of Marlene Cummins and her involvement in the party's Brisbane chapter in 1972. Marlene finally shares what it was like to be a young Aboriginal woman at the time and reveals the demons she's fought long to forget. Told with great sensitivity by Aboriginal director Rachel Perkins, the film will have its worldwide premiere as part of the Sydney Film Festival on Thursday. Marlene and Rachel both spoke to me about the documentary.
Bluesy knows your name. Yes, it always knows your name. The blues, it knows your name. Yes, it always knows your name.
Marlene, did it take a lot of strength to be able to tell a story that might not be welcomed by everyone?
See, when you say to me, Aunty Marnie, did it take you a lot of strength? I can look at your question from a different perspective. I took a lot of abuse. So what are we saying here? Are we reinforcing the silent code? Are we so unaware of being silent about abuses perpetrated on us by our own people? I'm being a hero because I've taken a lot of strength. Or no, on the other hand, we as a community, we as a nation have to start talking about human violations once again without growing through a period where it was convenient to have air black people's dirty linen so that it can be used against them to take their land, to take their resources, to take their funding. It's the same old mentality, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, I've got to say to myself, no, it's about me experiencing human rights violations, forced into a corner where I had to be quiet about it. No, no. I want to be a decent human being in society. I want to be able to speak out. And I don't want to be this seen as a woman who speaks out, oh, she's so brave. She's so strong. This is like, hello, a natural process that should happen. I should be able to speak out against anybody who's violating my existence. Because what I went through with that silent code, which was reinforced in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and sometimes through threats, I am not going to hand that baton down to my grandchildren. This is the depth of what we need, how we need to see how what I perceive my description as psychological genocide, you know. And one thing I will say about my documentary, I am very happy about the fact that one of the men who was around that period who speaks in the documentary makes an open apology. Yes, I saw this happening and I have to live with it. And all I can say is sorry. And it was genuinely there.
Were you expecting that, Marlene?
No. I was very moved and touched. Titters, the Aboriginal girls group, women's group that existed at some time, you had a strong message. There's a beautiful song. My brother has many diseases, but he is still my brother. So people need to read deep, see me deep, you know. I have gone through all these years processing my contribution. Yes, I was a Black Panther. I was growing also as an activist, eventually to a decent humanitarian. So if I'm going to take some sort of position about speaking out against justice, I need to lead by example. And in this case, I use my own truth to hopefully contribute towards that which I feel is symptomatic of society, institutionalised racism, sexism, misogyny, with my documentary, and inadvertently be a healing process. Because let me remind people, I am still quiet about the types of things I experienced and about a lot of men who I witnessed who are still out there spruiking about social injustice. we need to be very aware of what we have inherited, what we have assimilated our concept of holistic living in this country. We need to identify and name what we have inherited from the Anglo-patriarchal society that's implemented into our educational practices and so-called justice systems of this country.
Marlene, it's interesting that you bring up that point about whenever a woman speaks out against, say, violence, for instance, they're considered to be strong. And it's interesting that as a society, the way we seem to be conditioned to looking at that woman who speaks up. But as you say, it is something that both men and women should be speaking about, and it should be considered a normal thing to do, not a thing that leads from strength.
I would like to see it to the point when we address violence against women and children that it will be taken on such a grand global level. I personally would like to see the men take a more grand global responsibility and accountability, because they're the ones that are doing it as far as it goes with power and control and misogyny. And that's where the healing's got to come from, that accountability, that responsibility from the perpetrators. I'm speaking out because that's my basic human right. I'm not a hero. And that's the whole thing, conditioning of society. What they're saying is she's not strong. She's game, they're actually saying. Or she's game to come out with it. And what I'm not sure if I pointed out, I think I did, it's very difficult for an Aboriginal woman because we are still part of a cultural kinship system. We live in a family, you know, it's of extension. Extended family. We live in a community kinship, a community, extended community, family, community, and nationally. What affects a black fella or woman over in Broome or Perth dying in death in custody? It affects us spiritually because that's the realm we live in. So it's difficult for a woman to say something because she has to bring down a whole system of kinship, which have inherited a lot of belief systems of silent code. I mean, look, we've got actors, we've got performers getting pulled out of the woodwork now. And we must tell white Australia to take that role and accountability and responsibility of stop using the issue of injustice perpetrated by black people for a political agenda. And men from all backgrounds, they need to take the responsibility and accountability. They need to band together on a national, more global scale and take that responsibility. And it's that whole attitude too. It's a black thing that has been perpetrated by the so-called justice system. Oh, that's them native blacks at it again, beating up on each other. And that was a scapegoating process that non-Indigenous men use because they were doing the same thing. So they can be in denial about their own abuses against their women behind closed doors. So black men have been demonised, scapegoated. And so what I'm saying is, you know, education needs to go really deep in this sense. And finally, I always say it's the men that have got to take responsibility to deal with these issues.
Marlene, you mentioned the misogynism and the sexism of what you've dealt with in your life, and it comes through in this documentary. And one of the things that I found really interesting was when you go overseas to the International Black Panther Conference and you get to speak to those other women who were part of that movement in different countries like the US and particularly the UK, that there was kind of, I suppose, this unsaid thing that happened where you all understood that this was happening and that it was something that needed to be spoken out about, but that racism was the bigger issue on the table. Yes. And to take focus away from that as an issue you didn't want to do. I mean, what was that revelation like to meet these other women who, like the Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women who were part of the movement here, that they also took that as being the bigger evil, if you like?
Yeah, it was difficult to do that because I did realise that, there's no point in saying that was an issue then, because then you really never had the platform to voice it anyway in those days. I believe they're up there together, you know. I don't believe that you could compare the two. They go hand in hand, you know. So I have a lot of people who have no idea what Black Panther Woman is about.
Really?
And, yeah, I have young people saying to me, oh, Auntie Marlene, you was a Black Panther woman. That's so cool. That's so deadly. I'm like looking at them. Well, good, you go along and see it. Well, they did look cool and deadly. We did too. We adopted the beret and the black jackets and the black clothing, you know. And it was a good, cool and deadly look as well as a strong, you know, uncompromising approach to racism in the country. But Black Panther Woman, it also takes other directions of my own experiences and what I witnessed. And it's not all cool and deadly.
Marlene, tell me about the music, the musician in you and that side of you.
Well, yeah, I do have a love for the blues. I didn't know I was going to be a blues singer because blues music wasn't introduced to the shores of Australia when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s. A country was, cousin to blues and all the pop and rock of the day. And I always relate this story because I always get this question, why do you like the blues? Why are you attracted to blues? Because I don't know, it's just something within me. Because I remember the first song I heard on radio that was more akin to the blues was Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You.
I've made up my mind to live in memories of the lonesome time.
And the way he delivered it, and that depth and that gut and level pathos that he injected it. And I remember as a small child, oh, that got me right there, like no other, you know.
So I'll just live my life. Dreams of yesterday.
Dreams of yesterday.
Those happy hours.
And then eventually when I started and made a decision to take that path, as I enrolled at the Centre for Aboriginal Studies in Music down in Adelaide. Actually, before I went down there, me and Delphine Geyer, sister to Joey Geyer, Helen Arkey, and Betty Tapau, and we were trying to get a band together. We had a few rehearsals, but it's Betty Tapau was this amazing funk. She could do anything on bass, slap that bass too, and jealous boyfriends. I had one on the side too. Jealous boyfriends. We was laughing one day. We was thinking, oh, we ought to write blackfella style music. And Dell used to say, oh, we should write one about Pension Day, eh? And I said, because, you know, Pension Day, how big it is to blackfellas. Because I was a single mum on the pension where a certain individual used to come and see me. It was only Pension Day. And I remember hollering at him once, oh, I'm sick of you. You had to come around Pension Day. All this. And with that memory, I thought, yes, just the whole modern culture of Pension Day and what it is to us, and the fact that we love to laugh, make jokes, even though we have our hard times. And I did that as a homework exercise, and it's now become my signature song, I guess.
And where does this new album take you to, and what's the influence behind that?
Oh, I've had all sorts of personal attachments with the songs, and I didn't want to put certain ones out there, and I, you know, with the music producer, and there was that kind of emotional attachment to the song because every single song has got a story relating to my life and the politics that I feel. You know, the songs, saxophone, I do, that's the only, because I want to kind of, I guess, showcase my ability on saxophone. I do an instrumental version of Feels Like Rain, Some Kind of Wonderful, When Will We Be Paid? And also I did a change version of an all-Australian iconic song, Barefoot Boy, which was sung by a white woman named Nolan Batley. And I love that song when I was a little girl living on the fringe camp at Boomerang Alley.
When did you start playing the saxophone?
Oh, look, Rihanna, I love that instrument far back I remember. Every time I heard a song with a saxophone blaring in it, it used to get me in the gut too. I was fortunate enough to be probably one of the first people in Queensland, Ned Lander, who directed Wrong Side of the Road, and Graeme Isaacs, who produced it, they brought the film up to Queensland to show the community, and I was on the first ones, and I think it was me and Joey Guy to see it. And then I was just blown away. Veronica Rankin was standing up there playing a tenor saxophone. Well, I was led by her example. That's it. I love the saxophone. This is amazing. Look at this Aboriginal woman playing a tenor. I'm going to get me a saxophone. And I hired one for a bit from a music place, and I got a couple of lessons. Then I was reassured that if I go down the chasm, they got saxophones there, so I use their saxophone. And then I come back home to Townsville, and Uncle Eddie Marbo was around the community doing what he did well. He was in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. And I don't know why, I just thought, I'll go and talk to him, see if he can help me, give me some contacts to see how I can get a saxophone, maybe this funding or whatever, some kind of grant or something. And I went and talked to him, and lo and behold, it would have been about 40 minutes. I couldn't believe it. It was a miracle. He said, "You wait there, girl. I'm going to go and ring some people up." And he come back. He said, "My girl, now I just talked to the music shop up the street in the city about you going over there and getting a saxophone." I was gobsmacked. He said, "Now, if you go over there and you pick out a saxophone, I will be the guarantee for you that you're going to pay it off." What? Like, now go over and get a new saxophone? I said, "You're joking." He said, "No." He had this nice smile. "You go over there to the music shop, but you make sure, you promise me every payday you're going to put down $100. I said, "Yes, I will." I was teary. "Uncle Eddie, I can't believe it. I haven't been in your office long enough and you're doing this for me." He just said, go and get that saxophone now. That's how I acquired my first saxophone. So in my album cover, I give thanks to Uncle Eddie Marbo for being responsible for obtaining my first ever saxophone.
And do you still have that same saxophone, or have you moved on since?
I got that same one now, and there's no way I'm going to part with that one, the alto, yeah.
I'm suspicious of people who undermine the party on the gender issue. I'm highly suspicious. There wasn't the imperative of that moment in history to deal entirely with the gender issue. And we certainly weren't going to divide our movement on the basis of gender. That would have been ridiculous. We were already in a mass minority. Why would you divide your forces?
When you start moving, you know, getting out of the oppression that you've been under, and the men start wanting to assert themselves, you think you have to then hold back, step back, and let them go forward first, or what?
Well, I believe that a black woman's place is behind her man.
Did you know about her story and those things that we see revealed in this documentary when you went into wanting to tell this story?
No, well, initially, you know, Marlene had been a friend of mine for 20 years. We'd been in bands together, we'd hung out a lot, you know, we both lived in Sydney and we were mates, but she'd never revealed those things. And the things that came out of it were resonant to me because it's not just a story about the Black Panthers, but it also goes into how she became vulnerable because of her commitment to the movement by those men in power who abused their power. And for me, leadership is a key question. You know, I grew up in a family. You know, my father, Charles Perkins, was a leader. I've been involved in the Aboriginal movement all of my life and, you know, in filmmaking in various ways through him. And so I see leadership as a very important thing. So for me, a film about leadership was a subject that I was interested in. So not only was it about the Black Panthers, but then as we talked and as we met and as I researched more into her story, I understood there was a bigger thesis there about women, the position of women in the movement, how Aboriginal women saw feminism at the time in the 70s, and the sacrifices that they made on a very personal level to contribute to the movement and protect the movement. So that was a fascinating subject to me that I'd never seen explored in film. And you know, I believed in Marlene and I believed in the importance of her story, and that's when, you know, we agreed to collaborate on the film together.
Well, on that, Rachel, I mean, what was your reaction when she told that story about the way that she felt she had been taken advantage of by particular men in power?
This is a tricky subject. And as an Indigenous person who has contributed to the Aboriginal movement, who believes in the progress of Indigenous people, for me as a filmmaker to put a story that perhaps could be seen as criticising the movement was a very difficult decision to make. And I think it was also a very difficult decision for Marlene to reveal the things that had happened to her that shouldn't have happened to her by people who took advantage of her, who were leaders in her community. Now, I believe that we deserve good leadership and that we should, like we are with other Australians, we turn a critical eye to the government, we turn a critical eye to people who mistreat Aboriginal people. We must also be critical of ourselves. And Sam Watson, who was part of the Black Panthers and is interviewed in the film, he was strong in encouraging us to pursue the story. He felt like the Indigenous movement is mature enough now to look back on itself with a critical eye. And those words encouraged me to think that we need to begin a conversation. And that's really what this film does. It tells Marlene's story, no one else's. It's from her point of view, but it does tell a story of the wider experience of Indigenous women, not necessarily exactly what happened to her, but Indigenous women in the movement. And we need to have a conversation about women in the movement, the way women are treated, the place of women, and that we are mature enough to be able to do that without bringing down the movement, without taking away from all of the achievements that our people fought for. We still need to be able to look at leadership and be aspirational in terms of who we want to take us forward and in what manner and how they behave both in their public and private lives.
Rachel, you touched on this a little bit when talking about Uncle Sam Watson. And I mean, was that something going into this documentary that you were acutely aware of, was the reaction that some might have, particularly from those who were still alive from this time?
Yes, certainly. It's the first film I've been involved in that has been critical of Indigenous people. And all of my work to date has been, you know, promoting Indigenous people and the Indigenous movement and telling the Indigenous story in what I hope is a positive way. But Indigenous people are people, you know, we have faults. We are not superheroes, you know, we can't pretend that, you know, we are perfect. And certainly Indigenous leadership hasn't been perfect. And we need to be honest about that, because otherwise how can we improve ourselves and our communities? So I think I was very sensitive to the fact that people who were still living would have a problem with this story. But ultimately, it's Marlene's story. She went through these experiences. They happened to her. They're the truth from her point of view of her experiences. And it doesn't pretend to be anything else. It's not saying this is what happened to all women. It's not saying this is what all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men were like, because that's certainly not the case. But there was an element of the abuse of Indigenous women within the movement, and we need to face up to that. And if we can't face that ourselves, then we won't put a stop to it continuing on. And I think that was Marlene's point in making the film. She wanted to break the silence so that this intergenerational abuse of women would be put a stop to. And I think that's the first step in stopping abuse, is to name it. You know, we know that with other things like lateral violence, you've got to call this stuff for what it is and say that you're not going to tolerate it. And in a way, that's what this film is. It might be 40 years too late for Marlene, but she has broken her silence now and she's talking about it, and it's very brave.
And do you think this film, in a way, does show the strength of her character in not only being able to tell her story, but in the way that she's chosen to do it and how she has been able to really devote herself to her music and the work that she does in the community, but to keep going forward?
Yeah, look, I think it's a great story of her survival, because she, you know, has come from a very grassroots, you know, poor background, and today she is a grandmother, and she is, you know, how many other grandmothers have their own radio show? You know, she plays the saxophone, she's got her own band, you know, she's going to be releasing her new album. I mean, she's has all of this great success, and in her darker moments of worrying about this film and, you know, what she's saying, and I've sort of reassured her. I said, look, Marlene, you're an incredible person to have come through everything you have and still retain your sense of humour, your commitment to the cause, and your artistic, hugely rich life that she leads is a wonderful thing. So I really admire and respect her for that, and her courage for revealing the things that have happened to her, and putting herself out there publicly, knowing that she'll be criticised, but she's doing it in the hope that it will improve things for Aboriginal women, particularly in the future.
That was director Rachel Perkins, and you also heard from Marlene Cummins, who shares her experiences in the new documentary Black Panther Woman, which has its worldwide premiere at the Sydney Film Festival on Thursday.